when you recognize that Iran was paying for everything it received, you had two major things to consider. First of all, we were no longer in position to tell them what they would get. We couldn't tell them what courses their students would take when they came here to the United States. They selected the course that the student would go to. They selected the type of book they would buy. They were making those decisions, and that really ran a few staff officers in the Washington area right up the wall, because it cut their influence down to zilch.
It also cut our top-level policy influence by quite a bit. So that was number one that was given our MAG a little bit of difference in its complexion. But the main thing was the fact that our volume was bigger than all the rest of the world put together. And a lot of people, a lot of staff officers in particular, still wanted to think of Iran as just one of those 147 countries that we had agreements with and were working with, and they wanted to put us in a little slot. When we were no longer grant aid, we were all purchased, and we were bigger than all the rest of them put together. And the cooperation that we were getting with the Iranian government was considerably better than most any other place, certainly better than any other place we knew. As an example, I mentioned that I got out of Tehran, made a trip twice a week, and my trip consisted of flying 100 miles, maybe 600 miles, way out there, anywhere I wanted to go, 800 miles. I went over and visited the MAG chief in Turkey, and then visited the MAG chief in Greece, and I was just horrified. The MAG chief in Turkey had to submit a formal visitation schedule 3 or 4 months in advance of the entire next year. He had to tell the Turkish government exactly where he wanted to go on each visit during a complete 12-month period. The Turkish government hashed it over, modified it as they wanted to, and then gave him his visiting schedule, and he couldn't modify it. I had no restrictions whatsoever. And that permeated up and down the chain. But I had no restrictions as to where I went. As far as they were concerned, I could take off and change my mind in the air and go somewhere else. They let me have complete carte blanche. Now, that applied to many other things other than just visits. I could go in and discuss anything I wanted to with any commander. As a rule, I limited it. Certainly the substantive discussions to military leaders. But I was always invited to go in to see the province chief or the mayor of the town or whatever. Just, we didn't have limitations like other countries did. And that's what Doug Hank was saying. Let's recognize the fact that they are different.
Very interesting. Now, in the same letter, Alney also told Heck that he thought the U.S. should make sure the Shah had a coherent plan for making his weapons purchases. Did he try to follow up on that idea, or did he discuss that kind of idea with you, or did other people discuss that?
I have to laugh a little bit here, because the Shah did have an overall master plan for all of his armed services. And as I mentioned, M. Twitchell was one of the architects, one of the great assistants in getting that accomplished. They knew where they were going. They knew what they wanted to do. But one of the real problems was the fact that the Shah and many others read Aviation Weekly, the magazines coming out of France, Germany, U.S., England, all of them. They were avid readers on anything that was advanced state of the art. And as you know, these magazines are always dramatic. They in effect say things that are on the drawing board are already completed, and they overstate the capabilities and this, that, and the other. The Shah would become mesmerized over most anything that was new and he wanted. So Dave Allen's comment about a master plan in his purchasing deal was fine, but he was a kid in the candy store, and every time he saw something that looked pretty, he liked one of those too. So my major concern was not being a stumbling block, but at least holding him down until his personnel could properly absorb the equipment. I've mentioned that several times, but that was my one major talking point with him. The only thing he got a little disturbed with me about, because time and time again I had to say, I'm just not sure you have the horses to run this race. Why don't we wait a little bit?
Now, in the same letter Patek wrote, he mentioned something called Operation Enhance Plus, which I guess was an Air Force, U.S. and Iranian Air Force operation of some sort. Does that ring a bell? No. Operation Enhance Plus?
I don't recall that term at all.
Sometimes a Ball 72.
I don't recall that term.
Now, after our last meeting, you mentioned the Shah discussed with you his illness toward the end of your tour of duty in Iran. When and what did he tell you?
As you recall, I had a bunch of tumors removed from me. He just made a casual remark, well, we all get physical challenges every now and then. Says, I've got the same problem. It's really not too bad. You just have them cut out. It's all right. He says, when your time comes to die, you're going to die anyway. So, no problem. It's all casual. But he did, in making the remark, tell me that he knew he had a problem.
Did you report this to Helms or to anybody else? Did you pass this on, this information?
I usually passed just about everything I could remember. So if I had to guess, I would say yes, I did. But I don't recall specifically it being in the message. Because it was made such a casual way, that it was just sort of like a nice day. I could have missed it. Thank you so much.
No. Okay. Because later on in the 70s, when his cancer became known, it was sort of like a surprise to people. It seems like a
problem. Well, he didn't specifically say he had cancer. He said he had a problem, and just cut it out. It was his comment. Just cut it out.
I see.
Let it go.
I see. Now, around the same time that Jordan ran, oil prices were starting to rise. And Iran was starting to take some steps to take over the operations of the consortium that ran the oil business in Iran. Now, how much did the Shah talk to you about his oil policy and his goals in terms of oil petroleum policy generally? This was the subject of some discussion between you.
Yes, he went into great detail on that several times. Did I mention the natural gas?
No, I don't think so.
Do you recall the Russians put a pipeline down and siphoned off natural gas?
That was a steel plant for gas steel, right?
Yeah.
From the 60s, right?
Yep.
Right.
One time he mentioned that prices were disturbing him. I thought I covered this with you.
I'm not sure.
Maybe when we get into it, you'll say yes. He said prices were getting out of line and they were disturbing him. He gave us an example that gas that he was pumping up to Russia. And he said, I remember the numbers, 17 real, some a cubic, because I don't know the measure and how to measure the gas. But anyway, it was 17 reals for some measure that the Russians were paying. And that the Japanese had come in and offered him 80. And he says, we have something of a dilemma here. Many of my people are telling me that I'm not in a position to continue the contract with the Russians. And he says, I just like your view on it. And we bounce things back and forth like that. A lot of things that...
Maybe you did that, Jack. I'm not sure.
Really, I'm not, yeah. I thought so, but I did. Anyway, I'll try to make it short. He said, I asked him, I said, now wait a minute. I said, you see, you have a contract signed. I said, how long is the contract?
Right.
5 years. When did you sign it? A year ago. You remember that?
Yeah, I think.
But anyway, yeah, I said,
yeah.
Did you sign it in good faith?
Right. No, I
did the Russians sign it in good faith? Have they shown any indication of anything less than good faith? And I said, then I see them. You saw duty bound as an honorable person to carry out the contract. He says, that's my viewpoint, and a lot of people just tell me I can't afford to. He says, it's not about what you can afford, you decide to do it. So he stuck to his contract. Now the Japanese came in, started building an ocean that would get gas other than what he was sending to Russia, which was perfectly all right. But so far as I know, he stuck to that contract. And then one time he called a meeting. Tried his best to get a bunch of commercial people to tell him what the proper price for oil should be, the crude. And they wouldn't tell. They said it would be against their best interest to give him any suggested price higher than what they were paying at the time. And he said, well, the price is going up. And if we just let it ride, it'll keep right on going up. But if we have a target, together we may be able to manage and prevent it going right out the top. It still wouldn't do it so well. And this, I'm getting this secondhand, I was not at this meeting. He said, well, can't someone just come up with a figure and find that one guy? I don't know whether it's an American or French, but I don't understand that word you're dealing with. Right, with some other nation, I should say.
Yeah.
One guy said that he thought maybe $11 a barrel would be a place that they ought to stabilize. And as you recall, they did stabilize on $11 sometime.
Yeah, that's right.
But at that time, it was coming out of the oil, out of the ground, at about 50 cents a barrel. They're expensive getting it out.
There's the cost of production.
But, well, they had mines up there, had wells that were coming out with gravity feed. And that we talk about the seven wonders of the world and all that, but there are wells in Iran that don't have pumps on. They come out gravity feed and it comes right down the oil, down the pipeline, goes right to the island of Kark, and all they have to do is pump it in the ships. It's just the most fantastic thing you ever heard of. And that's not all of them, but a few of them run by themselves.
Did the Shah talk to you in general about why he wanted to raise oil prices?
No, I guess the only thing he discussed with me was that the price of oil going up was probably the most difficult dilemma he was involved in. because he says the last thing I want to do is hurt my friends. And he said that time and time and time again. We don't want to hurt our friends. Now, he got the national reputation of being the spark plug and raising the price. But at least from my observation, it was not that way at all. He was certainly going to hold it to a manageable level. But again, I'm listening to him talk because I didn't initiate any discussions in subjects other than military.
Did you get the impression, or did he give you the impression that he wanted to raise prices in part to finance his military purchases? Was there some connection there that he might
No. He never indicated to me at all that he had any money problems of any kind except a little bit of timing. Sometimes the cash flow was such that he had to come over in the Hanover Bank here that he worked with, Prince. He had to do a little jockeying back and forth from a timing standpoint. But as far as the amount of money was concerned, I never got the slightest indication that he was concerned, even a little bit. Just didn't bother. Uh-huh. He just felt he had all the money in the world.
Uh-huh.
But he was dedicated to one thing. He was dedicated to having a broad-based, viable country when the oil gave out. And as I remember correctly, as I remember now, he was thinking in 1972 of 17 more years. I believe that's it. The figure he used. He says, I've got to have a completely viable country that does not depend on oil in about 17 years.
Uh-huh.
That was his goal.
Be an exporter of industrial products.
They had agriculture, you know, across the board.
Uh-huh.
He called it nation building. He says, I've got to build my nation, I've got to educate my people, I've got to experience my people, I've got to have the infrastructure, I've got to have it all. In about 17 years, sufficiently advanced that we will not be dependent on oil.
Earlier in the interview, you mentioned some of the issues involved, or you alluded to the question of the base of Chabahar. Now, what were some of the issues involved in that plan?
Chabahar was a natural port area, completely underdeveloped, not developed, I should say, south of the entrance into the Persian Gulf. In other words, a base there would give an eye looking out, looking south to the Indian Ocean. So the Shah decided to develop a rather large base there, one that would support ocean-going ships, long-range surveillance-type aircraft, several squadrons of fighter-type aircraft, plus an armored ground forces unit for its defense. As far as I know, it was an original idea from the Shah personally. He decided to do it, but he wanted to keep it secret. So he called in the commander of the Iranian Navy, Admiral Rasai, and gave him his instructions to begin planning and come up with ideas as to how it should be arranged. Admiral Rasai immediately called for me, and we had quite a long discussion. And I was informed that his instructions were not even to inform the other services, the Air Force and the Army, ground forces, that the plan was being visualized. So that left Admiral Rasai well out of his element. Left him in position to do something that was beyond his capabilities completely. I discussed it with my Navy section chief. We got him a few American Navy personnel. We started as best we could drawing up just general ideas as to how we should go about it. Principally, the survey teams that would have to come in to find out not just what kind of soil is here, how deep is the water, what kind of breakers are there, how could we arrange it. So we came up with certainly not a comprehensive plan by any means, but an overall sketch of how we should approach it. The Admiral took it in to see the Shah, and the Shah was somewhat pleased with what we had, and told him to continue his refinement. And I finally went to the Shah and told him that the Admiral had gone as far as he could. He just couldn't be productive in his efforts without the input from the Navy and the ground forces. Then the Shah decided to break it down and let the other people in on it. So when I left, there was a great plan to build a relatively large base there. We had had several survey teams sent over from the U.S. To make some detailed plans. We had planning teams back here in the States coming up with a good many suggestions as to how they would approach it. But I left before there was much done.
Okay.
You've got to realize Shabahar was way down on the southeastern edge of Iran, and basically there was no road. There's a little trail, but actually buses got through some time, but it was always a surprise when they made it all the way. The only way to really get into there, and I think probably I hurt the Shah's feelings on that as much as any little thing that I did, because when he asked me to assist the Admiral in his plans, I got in my little airplane and flew down, looked around to see what was there. Just to give you an idea of what they had, it was just a little village. I went in, the mayor called in his council or whatever it was, and didn't even have chairs. They sat around on the floor. And, the mayor asked me if I'd like to share a Coca-Cola with him. That's exactly what he meant. So about 10 of us in the room, one Coca-Cola was brought in. I was poured half of it, and the mayor got the other half, and the meeting continued. So it was really a primitive little area. They had two diesel engines there that they used to pump fresh water. They were both pretty obsolete, so they had just turned one of them off completely and were stealing the parts from it to keep the other one going. But even at that, they were only running fresh water 2 hours a day. They were in trouble. They had a few crops, dates principally. They sold all their dates over in Pakistan. They felt that if they just had a way to get their fish to market, that they could set up a fishing industry down there, or a cannery. In the final analysis, just to show you how destitute those people were, after the discussion was over, I asked the mayor to show me what he had there that he was most proud of. He took me out to his cemetery. And we stood there and looked at a bunch of gravestones. He was destitute. He had nothing. But the thing that amazed me is in discussing his situation there, he never asked me for anything. He never said, I wish the Shah would do this for me, do that for me. He did say he needed an outlet for his fishing catch, but he never asked me to do anything. So when I went back, I went in to see Sean. I told him I'd been down there, and he was quite amused. Amazed, I guess, is a better word. Because I had a little plane that had a reversible prop and extra landing, strong landing gear, so I could go into most any type of landing area. But I had gotten in there. And he was quite interested. He didn't say, but I got the impression that the Shah had never been there either. I did later find out that the senator from that province had never been there. Never in his life put foot in that little area. So in discussion with the Shah, I told him about the requirement for a generator for fresh water. I told him about their selling all their dates. The only thing they really had to sell, that they sold them over in Pakistan. And I says, even when they listen to the radio, they listen to the Pakistani station. They can't get the Iranian stations down there. And I made a remark that I shouldn't have made, because it hurt the Shah's feeling very much. I says, actually down there, they hardly know that you exist up here in Tehran. And he says, they'll get change. Well, there was a generator on the way down the next day. A new generator. There was a bulldozer, some bulldozers put on a ship, and they sailed for Shabaha within a week to build a runway sufficient to take in a C-130 aircraft. We set up a schedule to go down once a week and get their fishing catch and bring it up to Tehran to sell. So he responded very quickly. But Shabaha was a big, and it was built. I don't know how much it was completed, but it was started anyway. Shabaha started from nothing, absolutely nothing.
Now, when you're making the first study of this port at Orange Bank, you relay this information back to Washington about what you're doing.
Oh, yes, sure, sure.
Were you, what was the feedback you got from Washington? Do you recall anything?
I don't recall any reaction at all, because we didn't ask for anything out of Washington.
Yeah.
I told them that the Shah was holding it very close to the cuff, and that he was making no request on the U.S. at that time. So that they had no cause to respond.
Okay. Now, that's sort of a rather general question to conclude with. Now, some students of U.S.-Iran relations have argued that between the 1960s and the 70s, there's sort of a basic change in the relationship between America and Iran, that by the early 1970s, the U.S. had less influence over the Shah, but instead the Shah had more leverage with the U.S. in terms of petroleum and so forth, and that the Shah could play a more independent role vis-a-vis the United States. But others have argued that the Shah remained psychologically and politically dependent on the U.S. He needed the U.S. for advanced weapons. He needed the U.S. and the NATO countries for markets for oil, and so forth. Now, from your experience on the scene in the early 1970s, how would you evaluate those kinds of arguments? Whether the Shah was still sort of dependent upon the U.S. in a sort of psychological, political sense, or was he actually becoming more independent in his ability to act freely?
I initially said that the Iranians trusted and looked up to us to a fault.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When they had their October 71 party, they started feeling their oats, feeling co-equal, and there's no question but what they felt more self-confident as the first years of the 1970s went on. I wasn't there long enough to had the feeling that they were contesting our advice or resisting our advice or certainly not in any way failing to cooperate. They at least gave me the impression that they were still just as desirous to have our support. But our support, as you will imagine, is now varying from give us this, give us that, give us something else to let us buy. But it was very obvious to them that they were not in a position to produce a lot of things they wanted. However, by the time before I left, they were completely rebuilding the jet engines for their F-5s. They were manufacturing their own machine guns, their own rifles, their own artillery ammunition, up to and including the 1.5mm Howitzer ammunition. They had a powder plant there that was as modernistic as anything we have at the time. They were coming along on their own. They were making their own decisions, much more so than they had been. So for someone to say our influence had diminished, that's exactly what we wanted. We wanted them to become independent. So it wasn't a matter of our losing out. It was a matter of just like parents delighted to see their children develop. We weren't, as far as I knew, except for a few small-footed staff officers, we weren't unhappy a bit in the world to see them come in there. As far as the national policy is concerned, I saw no indication that we wanted to keep them serving.
That's interesting. Did you work particularly else?
I'm through.
Okay. After you left Iran in 73, did you do any more work on Iranian-related issues?
No, I was medically evacuated from Iran and was quite ill for 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just, for all practical purposes, out of it completely. I did have the new MAG chief come by the hospital and visit with me a time or two and things of that sort. No, I wasn't in operational at all.
Okay. Are there any concluding comments that you'd like to make? You sort of made a sort of general statement towards the end, but anything else you want to say in addition?
No, other than I attended a party in an Iranian home here in Washington just 2 weeks ago. That party was an assemblage of about 30 real top-level Iranians. I believe all of them were ex-military. And I would like to repeat that those people, the top level of those people, are culturally refined, they're nice, they're polite, they're intelligent. I think we would be just happy to have them in our homes and our churches and our communities anyway. They are nice, nice people, the ones that I know now. And I hope the time will come when Iran will wake up, get on his feet, and sort of get out of its persecution complex. And that's what the Muslims are going through now. They are devoutly religious people, but they are really overcome by their own persecution complex at present. So much so that they feel that everyone's against them and they've got to fight back on every touch. It's not going to come easy, it's not going to come soon. But I hope the time will come one of these days before we can get
Okay, thanks very much for the interview, General.
Good.
Okay, good.